I'm not sure whether they tell us to start, so we're just going to start. And now they've told us to start.
You can start now.
This is going to be a theme for our hour, is David Carr giving us advice. It already happened once today when we were having breakfast tacos, and Noah showed us a video, and then Dave decided that it was time for us to watch it right now. So we're going to start our panel with this video on curation.
One of the most beautiful things about the internet is this sort of rabbit hole of discovery, where you start in a place that you're familiar with and you trust, and you drill down and you drill down, and you chase the white rabbit, and then you end up in some wonderland that you didn't know existed.
I'm Googling some strange vegetable, and then I'm Googling some Abex painter, and think to myself, how did I get from here to there?
There's something about the internet that makes every piece of content that crosses your eyes seem like it was made for you, and specifically you, and you must respond to it.
The reason why I pick things and blog about them, it's the big secret.
I see my role as getting people to see connections between things that they didn't necessarily see connections between, and becoming interested in that intersection.
A good curator is thinking about not just acquisition and selection, but also contextualizing.
Why am I choosing this? Why did I make this selection? What was driving me? Is it intuition?
I think people really respond to other people's enthusiasm about things.
Anybody can post anything on the internet. You rely on other people that you trust to help determine whether people are worth taking information from or not.
For me, the role of a curator is to find the most interesting things within this massive onslaught of messy information.
We all started our sites by writing to ourselves, but at some point, you know, you've got to give that mix of stuff that you like and you think is interesting, and then also thinking about what will the audience appreciate.
I'm just someone who's very curious about beautiful things, and I go out there and try to find them, and I save them for myself, for my personal visual archive, and that's about it.
One of my big concerns about the internet is the newsification of content, this idea that just because something is new and it floats to the top, it's more relevant somehow or better, and it's not the case.
I'm not one of those people who thinks that there's too much information out there. Filters are getting better, and I think we're all just as humans getting better at ignoring things that we don't need to pay attention to.
I think curiosity is a kind of intellectual hunger and creative restlessness that makes us grow.
Ideas are the most valuable thing. Good ones make all the difference. Bad ones can hold us back, maybe destroy us. If we can focus on finding the right ones, helping distill them and transfer them as quickly as possible, we can get more of them. Curation is that means to the end.
All right, that video was produced by Noah Breyer's company, Percolate, and that's a good place for us to start our introductions.
But we all curated the video, though.
Well, you really curated it yourself, but yes. Noah Breyer is the co-founder of Percolate. He has also had a blog for a long time at noahbreyer.com. Mia Q has very graciously allowed me to call her Mia Q, so I don't bungle her name. She is the curator at Flipboard, and she has done similar work at YouTube and Apple. Maria Popova is the founder of brainpickings.org, and she tweets at BrainPicker. And David Carr is the media critic at the New York Times. Fun fact about David Carr, he's also the only person on the panel of whom I'm terrified. So, let's just go ahead and start things off. The term curation, I think, like anything half decent, you know, is getting pushed into obsolescence by overuse on the internet. It means different things to everybody on this stage, I think. And it's not a fantastic word, but it's in the title of the panel twice, so it's probably going to get used a couple of times. And I think it makes sense to start by defining it. And maybe one way to define it is to define it by what it is not. And so open question for you guys. What's the difference between curation and aggregation? Go.
Well, to me, that's a good start.
Sure.
Although we could argue that aggregation has a human component too, as what Noah is doing with Percolate, where people think about those algorithms. Noah would probably weigh in better on that.
Yeah, I mean, so for my take on curation versus aggregation is yeah, one includes a human. I think curation is generally done by people, and they make choices and they make the specific decisions, and aggregation is done by computers and algorithms and things like that, and people are just more interesting than algorithms.
So, I mean, the most name-checked aggregator on the internet is probably Huffington Post. Huffington Post has several human editors. How does that fit in that definition?
For me, I'd say there's somewhere in the middle. There are pieces of it that are curated. There are pieces of it that, you know, people make very specific choices around what to put there and more around what to put there than what not to put there, it seems like. But and then there are pieces of it that are aggregated. So they're actually just sort of choosing what feeds to pull in and displaying them in something near real time. You know, I don't know exactly how they make those choices and how many stories, if they run everything that comes through the AP or if they just choose specific things and rewrite the headlines. But, you know, that I think, and, you know, maybe that's slightly controversial, it is curation what they're doing. There's a person there making decisions, and, you know, whether you agree with the voice or not, I think they do have a voice and they're going for something.
I actually have to sort of disagree with that. It might be a semantic disagreement. It might be a very utopian thing, but I think there's something to be said for having a moral lens, which is part of curation and not necessarily part of aggregation. And when you're aggregating content around a meme, around something that you know will, quote unquote, do well online, that's not necessarily a moral lens on the world and what matters in it, which I think is the responsibility of curators and not the one of aggregators.
Yeah, I think algorithms have a moral lens, though. I mean, I think there are people who put algorithms together and they make decisions, and generally those decisions are, you know, about what makes sense. Google, which is a bit of a different thing, maybe not an aggregator, but like the most famous algorithm, they have a moral lens about what matters on the internet and what's important, and they believe in people voting for content. And, you know, I mean, there are morals surrounding that and morals embedded in the code.
Oh, absolutely. But in terms of the Huffington Post as an example, these algorithms are geared mostly towards the types of content that would satisfy a niche and that would do well traffic-wise. And in my view, there's a disconnect that's fundamental to how we monetize the internet and how we think about the architecture of information today, that is between what should matter and what, quote-unquote, does well online and therefore is better paid or that sort of thing. And so in the context of HuffPo, those algorithms, I don't believe, have the moral lens you're talking about, the lens that they're engineered with on a higher conceptual level, right?
Well, I mean, there's a difference between having a moral lens and having a moral lens that you agree with, right?
Right. Right. So, but then we get into what is morality, then.
Oh, my this God, is, that was fast.
Well, welcome to the panel. David's other piece of advice was don't go down that rabbit hole that we just went down. I also neglected to introduce myself. I am the co-founder of a site called longform.org, and we curate, for our purposes here, long-form journalism, new stuff, and classics. And one of the...
But wait, though. Is curating, it's less about morals and more about values, right?
Okay.
I mean, you can choose from all the long form that's ever existed that has ever been digitized when you make your... When you do your choices.
That's in front of a paywall, yeah.
Right, okay. And so you don't make a moral choice, you make an aesthetic or value-driven choice about what is good.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. I don't think the moral prism works very well.
Well, it depends on how you define your responsibility. I see my responsibility as both an editor and a curator and to get people to be interested in things that matter and that they're not necessarily interested in yet until they become. And this is my own definition. And I think as journalists and as editors and as curators, we all have to operate by our own kind of moral definition. And by that, I kind of conflate morals and value in my own system of how I engage with information with my readers.
Okay. I think that you're bringing up another point that's an important one for us to talk about, which is the distinction, if there is any, between a curator and an editor. And Mia, you have an interesting sort of role with that at Flipboard. You're picking and choosing what from the web is going to make it into Flipboard, and you guys are very clear that you are curating and not editing Flipboard.
Correct, right. Yeah, I think curators and editors are the same in that they both have to know their audience and they have to know what keeps their audience engaged. They're different in that they work with different volumes of data and with content at different stages of its life cycle. So I see us editors as people who are creating content and curators as people who are packaging content. So on Flipboard, curation sort of manifests itself in many different ways. I mean, for one, your friends are curating content every day. There's, 175,000 tweets that are shared a minute. So if you can pull all that stuff into Flipboard and have a magazine-like view of what your friends are sharing, and then, you can create your own list. And then what I do at Flipboard is I help make discovery easier. So I curate at the source level, where I pick people like Maria Popova is like a goddess in our office. And then, also on the article-by-article level. So we might create special sections about South by Southwest or the Oscars where we curate articles from different sources into one beautiful magazine.
But wouldn't you say that this is more than packaging? So in the act of curating or selecting that content, you're in a way authoring a point of view on what is interesting and meaningful. And I would argue curation is that. It's more than just packaging things. And editorially, since the beginning of time, editors' role has been to frame for people what matters in the world and why. And I think curators do it implicitly by building a pattern of information bits, the sum of which has an overall message about that person's point of view in the world as what you're doing.
I mean, it's interesting when you say, packaging a special South by Southwest section, and I got here, I was given a copy of the Austin Chronicle, and they had a special South by Southwest section. There's the same editorial instinct. So, I think that line gets tricky in that way. But Maria, you bring up an idea that I wanted to make sure we don't miss. Yesterday, I don't know how many of you saw this, but Maria launched something called the Curator's Code. And I think it's important for our conversation here. It's a pretty interesting idea. It probably would be useful if you could just kind of talk on it for a second.
All
or
right.
Explain it.
All right, very briefly.
Very briefly.
Go ahead, pimp it out there.
It's something I've been working on for about a year out of just frustration and how we handle information online. And we think about this age of information overload. The act of bringing to people's attention that which is meaningful and interesting and relevant and enriching is a form of labor and a form of creative intellectual service that someone is performing for you. And yet we don't treat it that way when we attribute discovery. So the Curator's Code is basically trying to build a systematic way of attributing discovery as a form of authorship in the information age. So we basically took two Unicode characters, and these are symbols that you can use, kind of like the copyright symbol or the trademark symbol. These are Unicodes. And appropriated two of them. One looks like a sine wave, which stands for via, which is a more direct attribution of I found this content elsewhere, I'm reposting it here with little or no modification or addition. And then the other one is this like swirly arrow, which stands for what we now call hat tip, which is the indirect attribution of I saw an idea somewhere, it gave me an idea for something else, or I expanded upon it significantly and I'm posting this here. So that's the idea, to standardize the way that we attribute and mostly to build a culture around attribution of discovery as a form of honoring authorship.
And how can people get involved in that thing?
Oh, yeah. It's curatorscode.org, and there's a little bookmarklet that you can just put in your browser toolbar, and if you're a publisher of content, anytime you have your cursor in the text field, you can just click the bookmark and it's going to insert the symbol for you.
Aren't we hooked up? Can't you show it? It's very beautiful.
Right, I'll do it. I just unplugged
it. We'll vamp while you're getting that going.
Well, as the only person up here from a traditional media outlet, as the only person up here who produces original content, although I think...
I feel like such a token.
It's I'd like good you to speak for the entire publishing industry briefly.
Oh, I'm so grateful you're all here to repackage and repurpose me. And strip out all the ads, which, by the way, is how I eat. I don't think it's really actually quite that simple. I do think that in terms of nomenclature, we shouldn't get too hung up on curation. It's a nice word, but it's sort of twee. And I mean, if for hundreds of years, editors have been making and publishing products on keyboards composed of human beings. You hit one key, a story pops out. You hit another key, a story pops out. And indeed, you know, I think that the front page of the New York Times is one of the most significant acts of sort of daily curation going on, which is you have... I always thought it was funny that we would, in an age of a web age, and they have in the page one room, they have the web up on the wall. So these stories are all morphing and lighting and changing. And here, you know, 20 men and women are saying, what are the 6 or 7 most important stories in Western civilization today? And I think to myself, well, that's silly. But you know what? I do think there's extreme value in it. I still get the daily paper because as things are whooshing by, I like someone to go, okay, stop. These are the 6 most important. Arrange them in a visual hierarchy and set them out in a way where I'm not being pulled along by my interest. I'm being pulled along by someone else's interest. For instance, if left to my own devices on the web, I would never read international news. I just wouldn't. I wouldn't get drawn to it or pulled to it. But because it's in the front page of our paper, I end up in narrative on that stuff. And whether that's an editorial impulse or a curatorial impulse, I think it's a very important one.
And it goes to the point that Eli Pariser has made about the filter bubble,
yes,
right? And that is what I meant about getting people interested in things that they wouldn't ordinarily be interested in. I think great newspaper editors, great magazine editors, great editors in general aspire to do that.
To surface things that people wouldn't encounter otherwise. And that's basically the mission of your site, is it not?
Right, right. And not just things that they wouldn't encounter that are just cool, but I think there's also, again, a layer of, well, this is meaningful, or this enriches in some way.
Well, I do think that there's... When the consumer web first dawned, we said, okay, we're going to learn all sorts of things about all sorts of things. But people tend to click in self-reinforcing ways. And now we have, as Eli and others have pointed out, a feedback loop occurring with both, say, Facebook and Google, where they're really telling us what we want to hear, what they think they want to know. And so what looked like, you know, 1,000 flowers blooming is actually, you know, verticals of information that people self-assemble and go down, and they don't find out about other things.
So it's almost like they have a moral lens of it.
There you go.
I think it's sort of garbage.
I prefer to think of it as values.
Every day I run into random information that I never would have thought I could have discovered because of the internet. I mean, I totally don't subscribe to this idea that we're missing things because of the web. I think curators are great. Twitter is sort of a giant serendipity engine, right? Like you're just running across random things all the time. It's just sort of what people are flushing out on a daily basis. But, you know, I mean, every day I sort of search for something and find myself down some crazy rabbit hole, like you said. And I don't... I get the sort of distinction, and I understand that that's a newspaper goes out and they make those decisions, and it's great. But like even Eli's point in the filter bubble, which I've spoken to him about. I mean, like he was clicking on those things, right? He was making those decisions, and the algorithms may have been reinforcing what he was doing, but he was still clicking on the things he was interested in. We follow the things we're interested in, but like the hyperlink, the sort of very basic nature of the web makes it really great for like from following something you were interested in, discovering things you totally never knew existed, and it happens every day. I think we like talk about this thing as if we never find new stuff on the internet accidentally, and I feel like it happens all the time. Maybe I'm the only one.
I don't think we do, though, and I don't think it's a medium problem. The internet is a technology, and all technology just amplifies human nature in different ways, you know? And so this is just a human tendency to gravitate to what we already are familiar with and interested in, and in the process of it, discover things. But you could say the same thing of a great library, where it's so overwhelming that the way that you discover the most interesting and relevant is really when you talk to a great librarian. That is who opens those intellectual doors for you, because otherwise you could by pure serendipity, but it's so much less efficient and so much more scattered in a way.
So how does Percolate help do that? I mean, Percolate, you're using, you know, at least in its original iteration, you're using your Facebook and Twitter feeds and RSS feeds to find stuff, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, Percolate is basically a tool for curators. We work specifically with media companies and brands. But the basic conceit is the same as what we've been talking about, is that, like, people, like, curation is an act people do. So Percolate has a bunch of algorithms that bubble up interesting stuff and then make it easy for a person to make the final decision. Essentially, Percolate is an engine that sort of lives a level beneath and tries to make that basic job a bit easier by looking through what's going on throughout your interest graph and trying to pull out nuggets that are sometimes based on what people are talking about and sometimes based on, you know, like what one person is talking about, and trying to sort of mix that up a bit and make that job of, like, you know, if you're, we're all sort of curators these days, right? Like, that's what Facebook is telling us to do. That's what Twitter is telling us to do. They're all telling us, and that's what we were doing when we had our blogs, right? Like, blogs were that, too. We were posting a link and then writing a paragraph. And so, you know, Percolate is really just a tool to try to help in that process, because the job of being a curator is hard.
Mia, how is your job hard? I mean, it feels like part of what you're trying to do is to bring brands and media outlets that people actually are familiar with on the web into Flipboard. Is part of the goal also to find stuff that's new, to turn people on to new ideas? I mean, part of what's been interesting, and I want us to get into this a little bit, you have to speak for publishing again. I'm interested in the relationship between curation and original content and how much those two worlds are talking to each other. How have you tried to develop those relationships with publishers on Flipboard?
Yeah, so we have relationships with over 70 publishers right now, people like Wired, New Yorker, Rolling Stone. And what we do is we take their web content and then we beautifully lay it out in the form of a magazine and we paginate it. And by paginating it, and this is for all content on Flipboard, but with publishers, we work closely with them to really make sure that their content really shines, and we develop these custom template pages for them. So anyway, by paginating it, readers are going to read more, they're going to share more, but also by breaking the content up in this way, it creates these opportunities for bringing print-style advertising to digital. So that's, you know, a big program for us is working hand in hand with these publishers to help them bring print dollars to digital. And then the way my job is hard, however, is finding, you know, really great curators like Maria and content creators to kind of bring to the fore. So, you know, I think as Maria could say, curation, I think, takes to do it well takes as much time as to write an awesome blog. So it's I think they're sort of diamonds in the rough.
And Maria, I mean, you're doing both of those things. You're both writing an awesome blog and doing an incredible amount of curation on Twitter. How superhuman are you? How do you do all of that? When do you sleep?
Not since 2003. No, that's not true. Actually, my New Year's resolution has been to really crack the whip on sleep. So I have a system of 3 consecutive alarms to go to bed. And but I think...
Figures you'd set up a system to sleep. Most of the rest of us would just get tired and...
Well, someone's got to keep the bots alive, yeah. my tweet bots. I think the truth of it is that all that stuff that I do is just because I'm still learning and I'm still following my own curiosity. And then I think that if there ever came a day when I felt that I had to do it on this schedule, I would burn out just out of sheer like stubbornness that's something I have to do, not something I want to do. But I think it's what my studio mate Tina opened the curation video that we saw. She runs an amazing design blog called Swissmas, and she has the same ethos but applied to visual culture. And she started her blog because she wanted a way to visually bookmark things for herself, and somehow an audience tagged along for the ride because she had phenomenal taste. And I think the best kind of curators or even editors and writers do things that help them grow and follow their own curiosity, and that's what great content is, which brings me to the point about HuffPo, for example, or even worse yet, content farms, without going too far into that whole world. But I think the second you start developing content around a meme or a trend or some other metric other than your own curiosity, then the spirit of journalism and of curation dies. And my hope is that there are people out there that we try to keep it alive by just being curious ourselves and bringing that to our audience.
Isn't the media industry creating content for so that there's space for advertising, though? I mean, like...
Sorry, what was that?
The media industry exists to create content so that there's advertising. I mean, they're not nonprofits for the most part. Like,
right?
They're making money.
And I think that's a problem. So I run a site that I operate like a nonprofit, and I'm not saying everyone should. I mean, we all have different ways of doing it, but I recently read a letter that a newspaper editor wrote in 1923, and it was basically this rant about how the circulation manager had taken over the newspaper and was calling the shots for the editor because they were basically trying to sell the greatest number of papers, and they were engineering the headlines and the content around that because all that mattered was the ad pages and how many of those they could deliver to the greatest number of readers. And I think the content model for information today has not changed much since the day of the newspaper in 1923. And when we think about SEO and search engine optimization and things like HuffPo and content farms, this is what it is. It's a circulation management system that places the advertiser as a stakeholder and not the reader. And the way that I engage with information for myself, I'm not saying it's like a universal judgment, but to me, that's not right.
So how do you make money doing what you're doing?
Well, public media have been doing this for ages. This is how public libraries are supported. This is what public radio does, and it's support by readers, people who find value in it and are happy to pay for it, not because they have to, not because there's a paywall, but because they want to. And I'm well aware this is not a scalable model, and it's a very utopian view, but I love living in it. It's a great thing to be able to share a system of value with your readers and kind of live around that.
And do you feel like it allows you to not worry about traffic? I mean, to not be looking
right.
for
Absolutely.
The things that are going to juice your numbers?
Yeah, and one thing is that I'm very interested in, and I think I mentioned that in the video, I didn't really pay attention, but the newsification of the web. And Evan Williams of Twitter fame actually just recently gave an interview in, I think it was at news.me, and he said that one of his big concerns is that we're losing non-new content. And I think there are amazing archives out there, and I spent a lot of time on video archives and the Internet Archive and Flickr Commons and things that have phenomenal intellectual and creative resources that are hundreds of years old sometimes. And the web is not engineered to surface that and to bring it to people's attention. So when you don't have to worry about traffic and about what the meme of the day is that's going to give you the greatest click-throughs, you can afford to spend 4 hours in an actual library scanning actual books from the 60s that have beautiful designs or beautiful writing, and then talk about that and bring it online.
But so, well, David, I'm going to ask you, do you think that part of Maria's popularity is because she's cool? Because the things she picks are cool?
Well, I'm not going to say no. Maria is cool, and it doesn't. The cool is, I think there's a couple things going on here. One is there is a broad sort of change in the knowledge or informational economy in that, let's say that in when the profile of Frank Sinatra as a cold came out, I gave it to you.
My favorite long form of all time, by the way, by Kay Talese, read it.
So I give it to you, and you say, thanks, that's great, and you think, you know, David's smart that he liked that story and we're together. But now that whole thing is metastasized to where we've come up with a kind of referral or curatorial economy where there's this impulse to gain intellectual or social cachet through the sharing of things. And I don't think vanity purely explains it, but I think it's in there. I think that this impulse, there's a broad impulse to share that goes beyond sort of Montessori and kindergarten, and it's what Facebook is built on. But sharing quality content of a certain sort has become a huge sort of indoor sport for America, and that feels new to me. It feels different. And is it driven by narcissism, vanity, show off? I don't know. If you talk to my wife, she would say yes. So there's that part of it. It is the finding of part of the reason that Maria works and her thing works, and I knew her work a long time before I ever knew how cool or not cool she was, is she is able to do idiosyncrasy and serendipity in a way that I personally am not able to. So on Twitter, I create a sort of human-enabled RSS, and there's sort of super tweeters of people who do a really high sort of signal-to-noise ratio of stuff that pulls me across things I otherwise would not. And I think there's extreme value in that, and the world's smarter for it. The one thing I want to point out, though, is over and over, whether it's Maria, whether it's you guys who are representing content, is you look at Flipboard, which I use, or you look at your app, which I think is spectacular, and you go, this is so fucking beautiful. It is so beautiful. It is so great to look at. And I think three things are at work. Number one, black figures on white paper. Amazing, compelling design element. Just always will be. I mean, some of the best parts of that video were just black and white. That's one. Two is that we have been sort of trained. We've been inundated with all this clutter over and over, and not just in print, but most especially on the web. So when you strip all that stuff out, our stuff looks great. It looks amazing. I mean, Flipboard, to see your stuff on Flipboard is to like see it again, to see a long story that you've done elsewhere show up on long form is to develop a new romance for it. Part of the problem, though, is what's stripped out along with that is the business model that created the content in the first place. And so you're cruising on legacy attenuating industries, and you're representing their content with nominal, real but nominal sort of contribution back to them in form of traffic, but they are still fundamentally in an ad-based business. So sustainability over time is it might be difficult. It's going to be really fun while it lasts.
So I just need to process all of the stuff that just happened there. So what I heard there was that our app is fucking great, which is awesome. You guys should check it out. It's a long form app. app.com, long-form app.com, on sale right now, and it's fucking great. There's
I noticed
a blurb up there from David Carr.
Perked up when I said that.
I don't know what you're talking about with the ad stuff, but the app is fantastic. There's actually a couple of things that I do want to mention about what you're talking about. So one of them is that we post 4 stories every day, and we've tried posting 8 stories, and we've tried posting 12 stories, and we've found that there's no change in the numbers whatsoever. So I do think that now we're working with a very specific kind of content, which is very long, and no one could ever read 4 of those stories a day anyway. But we've found that where people seem to find value in what we're doing is in the limitations, is in having a very small amount to choose from on a very consistent basis.
Which is not that much different when I was talking about with the front page.
Right. You need a digestible amount of stuff. The other thing that I think is just interesting, it's not exactly on topic, but you mentioned it, is that aside from stories about sex, basically new stories and old stories get clicked on the same amount, which I think on the internet today is really unique, and it speaks to that kind of content and that distraction-free environment. Most of the content that's created is incredibly ephemeral. It's relevant for a couple of minutes.
Yeah, and that pushes back against sort of the ahistorical nature of the tyranny of the new that she was talking about. But you told me before we got up here. The weirdest thing you said is that 90% of the stories get read to the end.
That's just in the app. Yeah. That's been the...
I think that's wild.
Yeah, it's super exciting.
It is, but it's also very worrisome, I think, to your point about if you're presenting the reader with these two choices, having a beautiful, engaging experience that does not pay for the creation of that content, or having a shitty ad-driven experience that they don't engage with wholeheartedly, don't have a good design experience, then what does that say about the fundamental monetization model of content?
I mean, here's my actual answer to the ads question, is that the choice that you've just set up is a false choice. So I don't think that the only options are horrible ad experience or beautiful, clean reading experience. I actually think if we've got... Hey, all right. If we've got people reading, 90% of people reading to the end of a 2,500 or 5,000 or 7,500 word story, then I think the onus is on publishers to figure out how to find value in that engagement. I mean, I could easily see an advertising experience on a 10,000 word story where one company's ads run through the entire piece and there's some sort of connection.
You're acting like that's simple, and the consumer web is, number one, ads aren't really your expertise, let's face it. Number two, this has been the fundamental challenge of the consumer web. I'm not talking about search, I'm talking about display.
Right, and you guys gave up on the value of longer content on the web. The idea was that stuff wasn't going to work. People weren't going to read that. And then this thing came along, and people started reading it again.
I don't get it. We gave up on it? What do you mean?
Well, my sense is that,
I was in... I work at one of the biggest publishers of long-form content in the universe. I don't know what you mean.
David Carr, the only person on the stage that I'm completely terrified of. Speaking not for the New York Times.
We can hold hands during the hard parts.
Okay. I'm not asking to speak for the New York Times, but I think in newsrooms across the country, this is kind of awkward now, that in newsrooms across the country, people decided in 2006, say, that people weren't going to read long stuff and started investing in... they started forcing all the reporters to write blogs and write shorter stuff, and that was going to be the currency of the web. And I think if you look at the presentation of long-form journalism, even on the New York Times website, it's pushed into a CMS that's designed to get people to click off the page.
I think that's fair, yeah.
And if you've got a 10,000-word story, if you talk to any editors and writers who are writing at that length, the only goal is that people read the story. And they're going to be pushed into CMSs that are designed to get people to click to the next page. So I think that there, I don't, obviously, advertising is not my field of expertise, but I do think that there's an opportunity there. And it seems unfair to say that it's been explored completely.
Well, yeah, but I don't want to go back to, but the conundrum of it is easy to curate great content and create a great user experience absent advertising. No, it's not easy, but it's easier, okay?
Mm-hmm.
What the money shot is to do them both, right? Because
yeah.
Either that or make something so beautiful and so compelling that you don't turn toward the advertiser, but you turn toward the consumer.
And which what's wrong with that?
Which is what we've been up to. You know, we have, 2 years ago, when we announced we were going to start charging, people said, well, you'll disappear from the ecosystem of the web. That's it. It's over. Our uniques went up. We now have 380,000 people paying for something that was free, like water or whatever other example. So I do think that at our place, it's getting to the point where it's almost half ads, half consumer. The more consumer-oriented the revenue stream, the higher quality of the content. I think I wrote very far away from your topic of creation, but
so Flipboard is actually attempting to do both. So if you think about like Vogue magazine, you might read it as much for the ads as you are for the editorial. And so, again, by bringing like print style advertising to the tablet, we're hoping that this is content that the advertising is a service to you rather than a nuisance.
There's one more sort of financial part of this conversation, which I think we haven't quite gotten to, which is where Percolate is pushing itself, which is that it is not just individuals and it is not just large media organizations that are trying to figure out how to curate and how to speak that language. Can you just quickly kind of like explain a little bit about where you think brands are seeing value in this stuff?
Sure, yeah. I think, I've been thinking about this a lot because I have a company that plays in this, but like more broadly too. Brands, like all of us, spent the last couple of years like building up followers, but most of them don't really know what to say to them. And so they're more and more thinking about content as a advertising medium. They've now got an audience they can speak to instead of having to rent an audience. I mean, I think there's whole other questions there around, like, what it means for media companies more broadly. But I think brands are essentially building out content organizations internally. They're hiring journalists. They're becoming curators on their own. And they have interesting points of views, and they actually have a lot of interesting content. And so, they obviously, they have a commercial mission as a company, right? Like, without a doubt, they're there to sell whatever they sell. That's why they exist. I've done some work with Red Bull. Red Bull is, I think, the biggest creator of action sports content in the world, more than ESPN, I think. Red Bull thinks of itself as a media company that makes money selling soda instead of ads. Like, it's a very different way of thinking about being a content creator. They do pretty amazing things, and they create pretty amazing content. It just so happens that the dude who's doing a triple backflip is wearing a Red Bull helmet. That's about the extent of it. And, maybe they cut to a scene where he's drinking a little Red Bull at the end. But, they still put up all the money to do that. I think brands are, for better or for worse, brands are just now sort of in the ecosystem of content creators who they're competing with our friends for our attention, right? Like, it's, basically on Twitter, it's like, I'm either going to pay attention to, I'm going to pay attention to long-form Twitter account, or I'm going to pay attention to my friend James, or I'm going to pay attention to a brand, right? And those are the sort of like kind of major pieces of that space.
So tomorrow when Jill Abramson talks, she's going to talk about the New York Times soda that you guys are rolling out.
I think she's going to be pretty pissed you stole her thunder. It's called Brain Cola.
It's really twee. Okay, so we've got 15 minutes left, and I want to make sure we have questions because that was kind of like a little bit of a rambly conversation. So the only place you can ask questions is right there. So that's where you should do it.
Oh, now you got trouble, bud.
I'm not going to debate you in a video on YouTube.
Do I need to? No. So as regards this Max versus David monetization question.
I reject that characterization.
I have a question for Max about the business of long form. People really love reading long form content, reading those 5-10,000 word articles. People love supporting things they love. Have you thought at all about a mechanism whereby people can pay for content after they've read it, and that you might take a little bit of that and then give the rest back to the publisher? Press a little button, pay a dollar if you like the story.
Not publicly. I think there are people who are trying variations of that idea. There's a service called Readability that has a program that allows people to contribute to publishers. There's a service called Reading.am, which I think could very easily get into that kind of thing. And yeah, I mean, that's interesting. We're at this point, our focus is really on delivery, and we really want to continue to marry great stories and great delivery. And I think we've got a long way to go before we start asking for tips for doing that. The app is a pay app, I should say that.
Hi there. My only question, and maybe it's more of a remark, and I'll try to phrase it as a question to be respectful. there's a lot of talk about consumer-facing content, but the title of this is curation. And it seems to me that when I'm a big fan of Brain Picking or the New York Times, as a consumer, the choice I'm actually making is who I want curating my content. So in terms of advertising, I'm also kind of making a call that if you were, for example, to decide to run ads on your site, which, by the way, I'm glad you don't, but I would trust your choice in ads. So why is there such a huge disconnect between the act of curating content and the ad department? Like, why doesn't the ad department have a code of ethics saying we're not going to buy stupid advertisements that our readers think are useless and will never click on? That's my question.
Our 15-person ad department is in the corner. You can ask them.
I can take a shot at that.
Yeah,
I've worked in advertising for a while. I think broadly it just doesn't scale that well. Like, I think, you know, that's the they need to sell a lot of ads at the New York Times, and at some point, you know, like, you've got an extra 5% of your inventory left and you just need to sell it. And, you know, it's better to get the extra $10 out of that, or somebody's made the decision that it's better to get the extra $10 out of that extra 5,000 page views of inventory than you know, they sell it out. I mean, I think that's actually sort of one of the, I mean, this is, I'll try to do this tangent quickly, but I think, like, you know, what David was saying before, like, I think he's right in that it's just really, like, the whole ad ecosystem is super complicated in that, like, the promise of the internet to me from the beginning was that, like, people with really targeted audiences, small but targeted audiences, would be able to make a lot of money with their content by selling ads, because a targeted audience is more valuable than a non-targeted audience, and that's how B2B magazines have always existed and done really well and still are doing reasonably well. It just doesn't work on the internet. Like, it's just that model just is broken on the web for lots and lots of reasons, a lot of them having to do with the sort of infrastructure of the advertising industry and the way media is bought and sold. But it doesn't appear to be being fixed anytime soon, I think, is the, like, unfortunate but realistic answer.
But if David's model was true and more people started paying for media, the ad department would have less power, and so then you could start saying, hey, ad department, stop buying ads for Cialis. We don't want them in our publication. We have enough money from consumers.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just nobody's done that. And I think the reality is, like, only there's going to be five sites that have the scale. Like, the New York Times is you know, a giant newspaper in the world. And, like, there's three other giant newspapers in the world with the sort of scale that they have where they could actually attract the dollars and audience necessary to sell straight to consumers and make the sort of money they need to so they don't need to buy the Cialis ever, or don't need to sell to Cialis or whoever.
And there are some platforms that are trying to actually innovate on this. Kudal, who is one of my favorite curators of content and design and creative space, they have an ad network called The Deck, which works with sites that are virtually ad-free except for one tiny ad by The Deck, which is always tastefully curated for things from the design and creative world. And sites like Swissmas and like Kotke and really kind of respected sites use it, and it's as minimalist as an ad-supported site could be. But it also has the curation component applied to the advertising itself. So,
yeah, they're very rigorous about
a couple of things. One is, as you, to your point, as you become more consumer facing, you end up in a new relationship with the people who've opted in to buy you. And I agree with Noah that this is not across the world, but maybe is true for certain media brands. But as the Wall Street Journal and the FT and others have discovered, when you have an opted-in audience that is paid, they create the one thing the internet doesn't have, which is scarcity on the ad side. And you can use the old magazine concept of wantedness. You paid to get the magazine, so you're worth more. So I think there's going to be a lot of activity around that. Just not to push back, but just a point of experience. When I worked at a weekly in Minneapolis, I was, I right when I said that, my Minnesota accent came back. Oh, Christ, when I worked at a weekly in Minneapolis. The publisher decided we're not going to take any ads that objectify women. And it's like, I thought about it a little bit and go, well, we've got these escort ads, we've got these strip, you know, that's a 15-20% in the belief that we're in a contract with our readers. We ended up just getting the shit kicked out of us. And eventually the paper, the other paper, City Pages in Minneapolis, ended up surviving, and we didn't. And I think part of the problem was getting picky about ads, because on the one hand, right away people said, well, you guys have, this is a long time ago, you have a ton of tobacco advertising, and that's a proven killer of people. And whereas you get uptight about ads that objectify women's breasts. And so where is the, so we ended up on that moral sort of like slope. And the other is, we, sort of the fundamental brand promise was over and over was, any and all sort of information, and as soon as we started getting sort of snotty about what we would take or not, it seemed like our readers just hated that. So that's just one sort of real-world experience.
I've got a question for that relates to somewhat to taking food off of David's table there.
Why is everybody here doing that, man?
I bought this guy breakfast today.
Yeah.
Yeah, two Migas tacos, net $3.49.
So, for both Flipboard and Longform, it looks when you're using your apps as if you have these content agreements that you spoke of. But what's the nature of those? Are you paying NYT and the New Yorker and the Atlantic for copy, or, you know, what's the nature of the agreements?
You have to think of Flipboard like a browser. So everything is based on what's already on the web or available through social media. So you can search for anything on Flipboard and pull that in. What we pull in is fair use, so we'll just use the image and the lead. And then you have to go to the web view, which counts as traffic against the site. And then with our publishers, again, this is a content they're already making available for free through social media.
Okay, so you're just formatting it in the elegant way in which David spoke, and they're allowing it to happen.
Yeah, in long form, we do the same thing. We only show web pages that are available, and we show the web pages in full. And since we launched it a month ago, we have had nothing but good feedback from the people that are in there, and we've had several magazines come to us and ask to be in. So we just launched with a whole slew of new magazines today, including Brain Picker, but also Guernica, which is excited to be in there and came to us.
So is it just API sort of integration, or
it's not even that technical. We're just really straight serving web pages, and we're sending people traffic, and that's where the value is. On long form, we're getting dozens of submissions every day, people asking for their stuff to get posted. So that's kind of how that's working.
First, Maria, you plugged my book, The Information Diet, a couple times, which was really great of you, so thanks.
It's a great and book. I just did it again. Everyone should read it.
The question I have is mainly for Mr. Carr, though, which is we have this idea of fiduciary responsibility in major media now, in industrialized media, and I wonder if we're suffering from, we have documents like the AOL way, which says that AOL should spend an average of $84 per piece of content, and it should average an average net revenue of 50%. And I think that's I wonder if that affects all publicly traded news organizations, and I also wonder what role that concept of legal fiduciary responsibility has on curation as a whole.
That is such a great question. To me, I was in Moscow last week, and I watched our bureau, which is these people who are kept there at very high expense in Moscow all the time, cover the elections. And I happened to be there with Tim Arango from our Baghdad bureau, it takes 70 people to keep our Baghdad bureau open because of security issues, and both of them fundamentally uneconomic. There's no way that those things pay, and so I thought to myself, well, this is in a sense bad for business, but it's at the core of what we do. It's like a core part of our brand promise. And we covered the election in real time in ways. I was there. I saw it. We did an amazing job. And I just thought to myself, what business model will support this a long run? And it's Clay, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. To Clay's point, at a certain point, our shareholders going to go, look, dudes, you lost a lot of money in the last quarter. And what are you doing having these people all over the world? The problem is the Washington Post pulled in from the country, from their international bureaus. And you know what? It didn't go well for them in a business sense. It didn't go great. And so I think we need to maintain resources going forward, and yes, serve as curators on the world in the belief that our capital structure is stabilized and that the business picture will evolve to the point where, maybe we end up in the last man standing business and that'll be a good business, or maybe we start squeezing the consumers more. I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure the answer is not let's pull in and be less ambitious.
Okay, but this is not a totally wild thing to propose, but the way you talk about it is this is a public service that is for the national good that you're performing. So with that thing in mind, wouldn't it be reasonable to expect that some form of government support would step in? Would it only be between the business sector and the consumer sector to support it? Can we expect something like the National Endowment of the Arts or National Endowment of the Scientists?
Yeah. Well, when I was in Russia, they had state-sponsored media. It didn't seem to be very good.
I think that's a whole another panel in where I'm getting the wrap-up sign. I think we can all agree that we hope that the New York Times continues to produce stuff, and then we can pick it and send it to other people. Thank you guys very much for coming out.